Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Truth and Movies. Today, it... big screen treatment for tale of American clown threatening everyone's life and general well-being, like we don't see enough of that every day on the news. Wind River, Avengers assemble as Renner and Olsen team up to right some wrongs. It's a murder mystery on a reservation, but do we have some of our own? And Film Club, Martha, Marcy May, Marlene, must see, marvellous, or maybe just middling. We get your views on a cult movie in a very real sense. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hey everybody, thanks for joining us. Who's in today? Adam Woodward's in.
Hello.
And we're joined for the first time by Nadia Latif.
Hiya.
Hi, Nadia. Where do you hail from?
Around the corner, which is why I think I'm here. I'm just really easy to get to.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, you part of the broader Little White Lies family?
I'm not. I'm actually a theatre director and a film director.
Get out of here.
But sometimes I like to write things about how I'm angry about films. And so that's why I'm here, I think.
All right. Are you angry about the films that we're looking at today?
I've got a couple of reservations about a couple of them. But,
have you?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Where do you stand, Nadia, broadly speaking, on boat chases? The reason I ask this is that our friend The Futurist started a big conversation, well, it's largely a monologue because he's the only one doing it, about boat chases with a 70s movie called Puppet on a Chain, an old Alistair MacLean thriller set in Amsterdam. And indeed, Amsterdam seems to be, or indeed Dutch City, seems to be very much the central motif, because here's Stuart Jones, who says, I want to mention my personal favourite boat changes from Dick Maas, his 1988 darkly humorous slasher, these are his words, Amsterdammed.
Oh,
did
wow.
You ever see that?
No, I missed that one.
All right, well, you missed, and it's sensational. I mean, he very kindly posted a link. Mm. And it, as he says, it's a sensational example of the genre, employing such classic tropes as a character falling in the water after attempting to get on the boat just as it's speeding off, angry tourists getting splashed, an eight-man rowing boat getting torn in two. Very nice, which is kind of the speedboat equivalent, as he points out, of removal men wheeling a large item across the road during a car chase, which this film also has during the boat chase. And they've got two leaps over land in boats and a floating elderly brass band getting involved in the mix. If you're excited by boat chases, do let us know, listeners. Otherwise, we can just close this here and now. But, I mean, for me, it all began with that amazing one in Live and Let Die. Do you remember?
Yeah, that's not my favourite. I mean, my favourite...
What's your favourite one?
It's not really a boat chase, but my favourite boat scene is probably from Cape Fear.
Right, okay, yeah, the rapids.
Which is, it's a chase element to it.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, anything you want to add on boat chases, or I should just move on?
No, I think you should move on rapidly.
Because the other big news this week, alongside that with the boat chase, is Colin Trevorrow getting kicked off, or leaving by mutual...
Mm.
By a mutual decision, Star Wars 9. Now, a lot of people have said this is a worrying trend, that most of the Star Wars films under Disney's auspices have seen some kind of either reshoots or radical changes in who's helming them. I must admit that I rather regarded this as very good news after sitting through Colin Trevorrow's last film, A Book of Henry.
Yeah, so it looks like the Lucasfilm execs finally got around to watching that.
I like this tweet from Silas Lesnick, who says, Colin Trevorrow isn't directing Star Wars, but he left incredibly precise notes so that Naomi Watts can do the job herself.
There you go.
Hey.
Anyway, who would you like to see take over?
Do you know what? I think there's like any number of really able white men who could probably do that job. You know, I think Rian Johnson is like the logical person to take over and just do two movies. But I am going to throw out there that I'd quite like Cary Fukunaga to take a pop at it. I think he's shown that he can kind of do scale.
Who did the first season of True Detective.
Yes, exactly.
And who's also involved in one of our films this week, isn't
Indeed.
He? Right, okay. Interesting shout. What about you, Adam? Do you have any... strong feelings?
Not particularly. I kind of feel like with the Star Wars movies now, it doesn't really matter who's directing them. Like, I saw a lot of people saying, you know, anyone but a white man should direct this new film, and throwing out names like Ava DuVernay and Barry Jenkins. And I just thought, why? Barry Jenkins just won an Oscar. Like, why would he want to make a Star Wars movie? But
well, why wouldn't he?
Well,
I don't want to make a Star Wars movie.
I think it's generally...
Really? Yeah.
It's generally sort of...
I'll do it.
Yeah, it seems tough to actually get one of these movies made and retaining your kind of creative freedom on it.
Star Wars. Do you know who I'd like to see do it?
Go on.
Alfonso Cuarón.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just told you that.
I think he's...
you know why? Or do you know why? Maybe you do know why.
No, please tell me.
Because... All right, he directed the third Harry Potter film, which was so far and away the best of the film series.
Is that Prisoner of Azkaban?
It is the Prisoner of Azkaban, and he imbued it with such a kind of texture throughout, and the way he handled the story and the drama, and it was a complicated story, but he brought a tension and a bite to that plot, which I thought was entirely absent, almost entirely absent from most of the other films. They're not without their merits for what they are, but three is head and shoulders above the others. And I was always curious as to why they didn't invite him back for four. Mm. I'm probably speaking out of turn, but apparently it's because he's a proper director, and previously they had Chris Columbus in the hot seat. The young actors were rather more comfortable with Chris Columbus and his easygoing attitude as opposed to Cuarón, who said, no, that wasn't good enough. Go again and go again until you get it right. And apparently afterwards there's an element of the cast saying, we're not working with that fella. No. It's too much like hard work.
See, this is the thing with Star Wars, though. Like, Ron Howard is doing this Han Solo spin-off movie. Mm. He'll probably do a fine job. We'll come in without kind of bringing too much ego to it, and we'll just get on with the job. And, you know, he knows how to make a movie on that scale. And whether or not it's, like, the greatest Star Wars movie ever, so what? He's going to be, you know, at the reins... the kind of director they need at that point, I think, just to kind of make... I mean, this is a bit more of an unknown quantity, I guess, that film, but for Star Wars Episode 9, you know, if they don't go with someone like Rian Johnson, who I'd be surprised if it wasn't him, actually, I just think, yeah, it's a nice thing for people to talk about. It's a nice discussion point.
Right. Rian Johnson, who's Brick, and then what was the... Was it Jump Not Jumper?
He did Looper.
Looper, which I wasn't as impressed by, but everyone's... apparently very positive about The Last Jedi, which is going to be dropping ever so soon, but not quite soon enough for some. All right. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. You can find us on Twitter @LWLies, or there's the Facebook page. And if you'd like to come along and see us in person, we will be in the flesh Sunday the 17th of September at the London Podcast Festival. It's Truth and Movies Live. Tickets are available for our show, which starts at 9:30, conveniently enough, that Sunday evening at King's Place. Tickets you can get from their website, Adam.
Mm, and we're doing that around Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Is that right?
Yeah. Doing a bit of a Spielbergathon.
Excellent. All right. I'll tell you what we're doing now. It...
My grandfather thinks this town is cursed. He says that all the bad things that happen in this town are because of one thing, an evil thing that feeds off the people of Derry.
But it can't be one thing. We all saw something different.
Maybe. Or maybe it knows what scares us most, and that's what we see.
I saw a leper. He was like a walking infection.
But you didn't. Because it isn't real. None of this is. None of this makes any sense. They're all like bad dreams.
I don't think so. I know the difference between a bad dream and real life, okay? We're all afraid of something.
Got that right.
All right, Rich, what are you afraid of?
Clowns.
Ha ha! Indeed so. This is the Stephen King classic. All about summer of 1989 as a group of children in Derry, Maine, bullied kids, band together to take care of business because the adults won't, business being a demonic clown that's hunting children in their town. Nadia, you went to see this at Fright Fest.
Yes, it was me and 350 horror nuts and a lot of red balloons and free beer.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know who I was more scared of, to be honest.
Well, did you enjoy the film?
Do you know, I went in with such low expectations. So
why?
I hadn't. The last time I saw the film was the weekend of the Queen's Jubilee.
Was this the second time?
When I saw the original film. And I remember it because I remember when I saw the original being like, this film is pretty shonky, actually. It's not scary in the slightest.
The old TV series.
The old TV series. Right. Yeah, it's sort of in two parts and it's far too long. And of course, Tim Curry. So I went in with like less than zero expectations. And I've got to say, I was really pleasantly surprised. I had a really fun evening.
Did you?
Yeah, I had a great old time. Is it going to enter the great like pantheon of horror movies? Probably not. Did it leave any like lasting impression on me? Probably not. Mm-hmm. Did I have an absolute hoot? Yes, I did.
Did you? Okay. Did you find it in any way scary?
Yeah, I think what this film does is it's really got no like desire to create some like lasting unease. It just goes scare. If we can get 50 like shock scares.
And did they work for you?
Yeah, I mean, I did a bit of kind of like hiding behind things. The leper scared the crap out of me.
Really?
You know, oh yeah, leper with no nose. That's the stuff of real nightmares.
Okay. Do you find it funny, the film?
I did find it funny. I mean, I think actually, I don't know like whose writing hand it is that kind of went, I'm going to go for fairly gross preteen sex comedy. And I thought it kind of worked. I was like, yeah, I kind of believe these like really blasé, jolly kids. And I think they all look like they're having a great old time doing it as well.
Mm. Interesting. Adam, what did you make of it?
Yeah, it's clearly going for that Stranger Things tone, and
it's a genre. It's called the analog kids on bikes genre.
Of course,
it's an actual thing.
Yeah, I think our colleague David in his review referred to it as Spielbergia, which I like. It's, you know, it's interesting in that Stranger Things obviously borrows so much from Stephen King, but then this film is doing the same. It's kind of taking from Stranger Things itself in terms of the way it's shot and the kind of camaraderie between the kids, really
even
amplifying that humour. Yeah, there's even a cast member who people recognise from Stranger Things, who plays the kind of, yeah, he's the like the jokey, banterous one. And I think the film's real strengths lie in those scenes between the kids and, you know, them trying to work out what's going on and sticking together and then being kind of torn apart and ultimately coming back together again. And there's a point in the film, I think, which you kind of feel, could they just have ended it here? You know, this is what it's all been building towards. And it goes on for about another half an hour from that point. And actually, I think the fact it does that is fully justified by the end of the film.
Do you think so?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I tweeted a hot take afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
Missing two letters from the title. I really, and any number of suggestions, but it could have been EX.
Yeah, right. I mean, you don't fare well with horror.
Well, you see, now this is the thing. You've sat next to me at screenings. I scare easy.
I've sat next to you in non-horror films, and you've leapt out of your chair.
Yeah, I mean, I screamed. I stood up and screamed in Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Oh yeah,
Large Marge. Yeah,
yeah,
but I didn't get scared. There was maybe one jump in this film for me. I mean, obviously they assemble a lot of horror elements, classic scare manoeuvres, but it was a bit like, I don't know, a theme park ride. Mm. You know, they strap you in and away you go, and then something lurches out of the darkness at you. But it was all very mechanical. I never got any kind of buzz off it. The kind of coming of age element, the Stand By Me Kingian theme to it, worked reasonably well, but I didn't find it particularly funny, and I really didn't find it scary. So as such, I was just left pining for Stranger Things.
No. Well, I mean, I wouldn't say I was particularly scared by it.
It's exhilarating.
Well, just in terms of like the jump scare manoeuvres it's employing.
Yeah.
But then I am someone who's sort of quite desensitised to sort of mainstream horror movies just through having been exposed to them at a very tender age. And you know, I often think, well, I'm sure other people will be scared by this, even if I'm not necessarily jumping out of my seat. And to me, the actually terrifying stuff in the film was the less direct horror stuff, the more thematic stuff.
For example, the abusive father.
Well, I mean, yeah, this is basically a film about, you know, the fear of growing up and becoming your parents. And the adults in this film are terrifying. Really genuinely terrifying.
Well, that's interesting, because I'm not sure if I got that from them. I think it's a very interesting angle to the movie. I'm not sure if that necessarily came across to me. On that subject, I do find it a bit weird, and this is a tie-in, I guess, with Book of Henry again, this idea of having a sexually abusive father used as a plot device in a horror movie. We saw it in Book of Henry. It's used here, and it just seemed really indelicate, out of place. I don't know what the appropriate word
would
be.
I think the film skips over a bunch of like things where I'm like, actually, I think that's a really cheap shot. And I think parental abuse is one of them. I think that the way that it deals with race, it kind of just like skirts over it.
All right, well, let's talk about that, because one of the characters in this is...
Yeah, it's the sort of token black, you know, magical Negro. And if you don't know what a magical Negro is, just think every part that Morgan Freeman's ever played, you know, who just kind of turns up to be the muscle and give a bit of kind of like mystical background. And actually, as you pointed out in the original TV series, he's supposed to be the kid who has like all the knowledge, like he's done all the research. And in this, he's just kind of the muscle farmhand, I think. Mm. And so, yeah, it does skip over that. But then it is this kind of kid's vision of the world, right? Like all of the adults are grotesque and, you know, terrifying. And actually, I think the thing that it does best is the bullies. I found the bullies scary, you know, these endlessly pursuing monstrous boys who are just violent. I was like, this is actually the stuff of nightmares to me.
It reminded me of how much scarier I found Dazed and Confused, say, than this. It is Dazed and Confused, Richard Linklater, isn't it?
Yeah,
Dazed and Confused. And in fact, this was my issue, and clearly this isn't one that you guys share, but I just thought everything I'd seen in this film, whether it was kids riding around on bikes or going to quarries or any of that, or even the clown, I'd seen done better elsewhere. And I'm amazed, because I'm so easily scared, and clowns are usually so scary. The whole kind of, what's it called, coulrophobia, the irrational fear.
Something like that, cholerophobia.
Cholerophobia. Yeah. How little impact the clown made. Did you feel, with your knowledge of clowns and their kind of their psychic potential to disturb, did you feel that they made enough of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually the one thing that I've got to really commend about this movie is I think it looks classy as hell. I think the cinematography is great. I think the production design is awesome. I think the costume design is mega. And so actually I think it looks like a much better film than it probably is in a lot of ways. And that's cool, you know, and I think it's lucked into a lot of things. I think it's lucked into this look. I think it's lucked into those performances. So in a way, it's a lot better than it should be. It's also like a really cheap, like, we're going to make a sequel type movie as well. Like, we're just going to set you up for the second half. And so, like, but for all of those things, I just think the fact that you have a nice time while watching it is not to be underestimated. Like I said to a friend afterwards, I was like, don't go to the cinema and watch it, maybe, but, like, next Halloween, totally watch it on DVD.
Okay.
Like, a hoot.
What kind of number would that represent, do you think, in terms of a recommendation? Would that be a 3 or just a high 2?
No, it'd be a 3.
Okay, yeah. So in terms of expectations, you were low, 0.
Is there a minus 5 on expectation?
Really? Okay, and then around about a 2, and now...
Yeah, 3, pleasantly surprised, actually. Yeah.
Adam, there's probably something else you wanted to add before we got into your scores.
I can give my scores now, if you like.
All right, go for it.
I would go for sort of 2 for the and for anticipation. Although, I actually didn't realise that Cary Fukunaga had written the... helped out on the screenplay for this. So, yeah, maybe if I'd have known that before, it might have bumped it up to a 3.
Well, I think you've also got to think about why Cary Fukunaga's not directing this movie.
Right. And yeah,
why isn't he directing this?
Well, he dropped out. He was going to write and direct it, and then there was the eponymous creative differences.
Oh, really?
He was attached to it along maybe like 3 or 4 years ago almost, and I just assumed he had completely stepped away from the project. I don't know how, essentially, they've probably reused some of his initial script draft, but
okay.
I don't know how involved he was in the project.
So it went to Andy Muschietti, who's an Argentine director. I'm not familiar with his work particularly.
Maybe there was it 2013. He made Mama, which is like a pretty decent Guillermo del Toro light horror film. It's a decent film. It's got Jessica Chastain in it, which is quite a pleasant surprise. It's fine. I just heard that he's making a Dracula prequel as his next movie.
Who, Muschietti?
Yeah, apparently. Which I
a Dracula prequel.
Yes. This time, you know, before he's dead, I guess. I don't know, but that I heard that on the grapevine yesterday.
Interesting.
So my enjoyment score.
Yes.
And my in retrospect score would probably be 4 for this.
Really?
Yeah, because even though I wasn't particularly scared, I think there's so much that this film does right. I mean, all the stuff that Nadia listed earlier.
Have you not been listening to a word I said?
No, I'm sorry, I disagree with you on this one. I can understand what, you know, I think it is a film which sells itself on its ability to scare you, and I think if it doesn't do that, then yeah, maybe you can't score it that highly. But I almost wasn't expecting it to scare me, and it didn't particularly. So I was more interested and excited by the other stuff.
Okay, I mean, I don't want to spoil the surprises, but the clown's inability to actually do the bad stuff it was supposed to be doing, I found a major letdown. I would say that I had quite high expectations, which may not be unconnected with the fact that I didn't enjoy it very much. I thought it was like 4 or something going in, 2, and still a 2. And that's, there you go. So you've got a 66.6% chance of enjoying this film.
Bill Skarsgård is very good as
Did you think so?
I think so, yeah. It's a tough one because he's always going to be compared to Tim Curry. It's such an iconic horror villain. I think so.
I think we've misremembered it, man. Seriously, nostalgia does funny things to the brain.
Maybe, but even so, even through that lens of nostalgia, I think people recognise that character and that performance. And, you know, he's kind of given it his all in this one. It's not particularly subtle performance, but I like the way they bring the character to life. I like all the subtle stuff. They don't use a lot of CGI in this movie, but there's little things like his eye kind of dropping off to one side.
Right, which apparently is genuinely, that's his eye doing it.
That's not CGI.
That's something that he does. Yeah. Anyway, that's it. And next up, we'll see how much we agree or not about Wind River.
I know you're looking for clues, but you're missing all the signs. Come here, let me show you. See this here? This is a sled track, right?
Okay.
You see out here on the ridge? You'll see it a lot easier there. You see those tracks go up that mountain there?
Yeah, I see it.
All right. Natalie's body was found just past there, right? So someone unloaded a sled right here, drove all the way out there. There's no tracks coming back. Why is that? I'm telling you. The answers are out there.
Hey, look, I don't know how to do this, okay? I'm not a tracker.
That's okay. That's all I do. Look, they asked me to help you, right?
Yeah.
We should go while I still can.
There you go. Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen, teammates in the Marvel Universe and avenging in a very real sense here as well in this story, a murder mystery set on a Native American reservation in Wintry, Wyoming. Renner is a US Fish and Wildlife Service agent. Not familiar with that branch of the...
He's a tracker.
He's a tracker, yeah. And he's tracking a lion that had been feeding on local cattle when he stumbles upon something altogether darker. Adam.
Yes. We saw this together.
Yes.
And had a right old ding-dong after the screening about the...
A scrap on the streets.
About the fact that... So the film opens with a title card that says, based on actual events.
Yeah, which immediately you got upset about. And Nadia, apparently you do too.
I wasn't upset by it, but I think in this instance it's quite a lazy get-out clause for a film like this to deploy. It's basically saying...
Well, if it is based on actual events, what do you want it to say?
Well, it doesn't need to say it. I think if you know you're writing a screenplay based on actual events, the quality of your writing should be good enough to do justice to those events.
But if I told you an amazing story and that story also happened to be true, wouldn't you want me to add that detail in? And by the way, all that actually happened.
But all films are based on. To some extent based on
Yeah, but that's not what they mean by this. It's not like this is something that is based on the fact that there are humans who do things like kill people. So, this is based on an actual incident that took place in Wyoming.
So we should also say that the film is set on a Native American reservation in Wyoming, and it's kind of bookended by these two factual tidbits. And the final thing, which I won't spoil, but basically it gives the statistic relating to Native American women.
Now, that I completely agree with. And we can maybe come on to that later on, because that's right at the end of the film.
Yeah.
And I do agree there's an issue with that. But what did you make of the kind of 90 minutes in between?
The 90 minutes in between, I think, it really ebbs and flows. There's moments where I was really, really with this film, really enjoying it as a sort of slightly icy, noirish crime mystery thriller. I think the characters maybe let it down a little bit. Jeremy Renner as we sort of saying the token white saviour figure. It's just frankly not that interesting, I don't think, as a character. There's a lot of dialogue and posturing and everything is telling you that he's this really mysterious, interesting guy.
He's being soulful, Adam. I'm sorry.
The soulful stuff, yeah. He does channel the sort of Native American mysticism while those characters are kind of relegated to the sidelines a lot. And I mean, Elizabeth Olsen is a terrific actor, and I think someone who... It's nice to see an actor of that stature not just making Marvel movies, actually, you know, doing something like this. And ditto Jeremy Renner, actually, as well. But I think you could effectively write her out of this movie and it wouldn't actually change it that much.
Yeah.
It would change the focus slightly, but her character is just there to be told what to do, to essentially play the victim later on as well, or be put in a position of being a victim. She's essentially there to be saved, which is a bit of a troublesome thing.
So
I think
this movie ebbed and flowed. You were with it, you were without it. How did you end up on it?
I ended up probably having more reservations with it than positives to say about it.
Okay. Nadia, dare I ask what you made of it?
I am refusing to call this film by its real title, and I'm only going to refer to it as White Savior Complex, the Sub-Zero edition. I mean, I just kind of, my mind boggled that this film got greenlit. It smacks of kind of Oscar campaign from Jeremy Renner, who's like, you know, third time lucky if I play this kind of deeply meaningful part where I just sort of spout semi-mystic bon mot. My favourite bit of the movie, actually, is where one of the Native American characters, who doesn't even get a name, it must be said, you know, Jeremy Renner's trying to tell him about, you know, we have to respect this land and it's all that we have. And he just turns to him and goes, what's this we shit? And actually, that was the tone in the film that I suddenly was like, oh my God, this film understands that it's really problematic to have two white people basically solving problems in a Native American reservation. But then it kind of never surfaces again, that tone. So I wonder if it was kind of a fluke. I mean, besides the fact that all the Native Americans are relegated and barely have names and are just there to be saved or to be drunk or to be drug addicts, I actually find the Elizabeth Olsen presence in it really problematic. I'm like, A, it's naff. It's this kind of 90s throwback. Let's get the green female agent in. And, you know, she totters in high heels in the first scene, despite the fact she's come to Wyoming, because clearly that she's a woman, she's an idiot, right? She's sort of arbitrarily kind of a romantic interest at some point, although that's never...
What you read into it, that's never actually directly shown.
You know, at the end, you're sort of like, is she supposed to be? And also, she's incompetent. And I was like, I don't get why she's, why can't she be good at her job?
Can I just interject there? The romantic element is interesting because I was assuming that Jeremy Renner was almost going to represent like a surrogate father figure to her, because there is a thing in this film about daughters and fathers, and it's like a recurring theme. And yeah, that doesn't really materialise either, and nor does the romantic stuff between them.
She's also got no backstory. We don't know who she is. She turns up, there's no backstory, and then she kind of bogs off.
Well, yeah, but that's the same thing that you're saying is lacking. Oh, I see. You're saying that, yeah, because she's a woman, she doesn't get a backstory.
Yeah, yeah, nobody in this movie gets any backstory. Story besides Jeremy Renner, and actually he's just not that interesting.
Well, it's funny you say that, because is it Jill or Gil Birmingham playing Martin Hansen, who does get a backstory and isn't just there to be drunk or take drugs? He does actually have an active role in the emotional drama, because this film has, it's got its kind of police procedural on action side, but it's also got a kind of an emotional side to it. And much, as I suppose, as in Hell or High Water, where Taylor Sheridan is also to a degree touching on the kind of economic misery and the motivations that spill out of that for the action, which then unfolds. Here, there's a lot of talk about mourning and loss and how to deal with it, which I thought was reasonably interesting and well handled.
Oh no, the scene where he turns up and the two fathers, you know, hold each other and weep is really touching. And actually, that's the movie I wanted it to be about, which is just about how communities deal with grieving, actually, and what that means to lose a member of such a small community. Never resurfaces.
Well, you get a lot of shots of Jeremy Renner about to cry, which I think he does really well. I didn't know he could do that quite
as well.
Kind
of near crying.
Near crying, but still kind of holding it together because he's a tough guy. I don't know. Taylor Sheridan, there was a lot of interest in this film because it's his first proper directorial job, is that right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And previously he did Sicario, which everyone was wowed by, me a bit less, but and what I thought was a terrific film, Hell or High Water. And I think he does a pretty good job directing this. I think he gets great performance out of Jeremy Renner and the police chief and Jill Birmingham. And I guess Elizabeth Olsen, as you say, is this kind of slightly kind of Clara Starling, or whatever her name is.
Clarice Starling. I wish. Oh, my God, that would have been amazing. Imagine she turned up and known everything. How awesome this film would have been.
Imagine if she'd have turned up and bought a coat. Yeah, that would have been...
Well, it's based on real events, so they can't help it if she turned up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's convenient when real events mean that men write women as idiots. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know what I mean, though, with that whole based on actual events thing?
Totally.
I don't have an issue with that, but we will come on to the other thing, which I think is more...
But the point of that is it's trying to give emotional resonance to a movie that actually hasn't written that into the script. You go, but it's real, so you have to be sad. And I'm like, well, it's not... specifically based on an event. It says based on some events, right?
Well, I would assume, and you're right, it is slightly ambiguous or even ambivalent.
This story has happened to someone somewhere.
I assume they mean slightly more than that.
I think that one of the things in this movie is about how it really underuses the things that it actually has within it. And can I just say how gutted I was when John Bernthal turned up and I realised he was only going to be in 5 minutes of the movie.
Oh, you wanted him in more?
Oh my God, I love him so much. I was like, he's going to have this big movie moment because he's mainly a TV actor. And then it's all over in 5 minutes and I was absolutely gutted.
Yeah, I was thrilled when he
turned. Well, we kind of turned to each other and went, oh, there we are. Here's the John Bernthal moment. Yeah. He's in so much.
But he's never had that moment, has he? He's never had like his big film moment. And I was like, maybe this? Nope, he's gone.
He gets to do his John Bernthal thing.
It's great.
It's very, it's like a kind of compact John Bernthal performance.
A little dose of that. I would accept this is a much more straightforward film than either Sicario or Hell or High Water is. It does conform to one or two, or several probably, kind of Hollywood stereotypes, as you say, the white saviour or whatever, but no more so than pretty much any other thriller out there, certainly any Tom Cruise film or anything like that. And I thought that Taylor Sheridan did bring some other elements to this. I totally agree with you, though, that, and this is this business about what it says at the end when it produces a stat about Native Americans to suggest, and this is why we made the film, and this is the issue we're trying to shed some light on. And it's crazy to pretend that's what your film about is when it's actually not been about that. It's been about how badass Jeremy Renner is with a rifle.
That really left a sour taste, actually, I think, that final message, because the film is not told from the perspective of those victims or that community, really. It's set within the community, but it's not trying to offer any kind of resolution or answers there at all. I thought that was actually quite negligent on the part of Taylor Sheridan.
Mm. All right. Adam.
Scores.
Yes.
I'd say probably 3-3-2 for this. Just the three for enjoyment. There, you know, if you just approach it as a sort of taut, frosty thriller, it is enjoyable on some level.
It's
competently
thriller,
made. You just have to not engage with all the other difficult stuff that the film does or is about. So, yeah.
Nadia?
I think I had a 4 going into this. I love a kind of like 90s, early noughties detective film. So, you know, I was kind of hoping for one of those. And in part, you do get that. Mm-hmm. I would argue the crime in it is not complicated enough, which maybe would have helped
it if it had been straightforward.
You know, the bad guys kind of introduced and you're like, who are these guys? What? Don't care. And so that was slightly disappointing. But enjoyment, 2, really? Maybe. I mean, I just, particularly that sound note at the end, you're just like, well, that's it. I think I was so cross, I nearly threw my water bottle at the screen. But I just, nothing in this movie conquered the reservations that I had about it.
Okay. And you made an interesting comment about Jeremy Renner comparing him to Spud, and you said you would rather see Michael Shannon. How amazing Michael Shannon would be.
Jeremy Renner, you are a poor man's Michael Shannon. Like, get Michael Shannon in this movie,
really,
rewrite
for
the movie.
For me, they're such different things. Michael Shannon is just, he's out there. And
Michael Shannon is a good actor. Jeremy Renner is a terrible actor.
Do you not think he did well in this?
No, I think he's doing a really good performance of a performance in this film. Like, he's thinking, man, if I could just be like Michael Shannon, this movie's going to be great.
Isn't it just that Michael Shannon's got really starry eyes that make you think there's mad things going on in there?
Yeah, it helps.
Yeah. Okay, well, my numbers, for what they're worth after all of that, I had no expectations going in because I didn't know anything about the film. Really enjoyed it as a tour. As you say, slightly derivative thriller, one that actually had some kind of emotional resonance and some things to say about an issue, in this case, how to deal with loss. So I'd say 4 at the time and 3 afterwards because you guys have talked it down so much. Anyway, I'd still say go and see
through.
It.
We're getting through.
Anyway, that is Wind River. And next up is another Elizabeth Olsen flick, as we re-enter the Little White Lies Film Club.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh, you've got a really nice place here.
It's as much yours as it is mine. I thought you quit.
I did.
I worry for you.
I know.
I'm sorry.
Don't apologize to me, it's your body. Zoe, look after this girl. For once in her life, she deserves some real care.
I will.
She's been great. Everyone's been really great.
Good. Martha. You look like a Marcy May.
Marcy was my grandmother's name.
Wow. There you go.
Little White Lies Film Club, everybody, in which all together now we watch a classic film, a film you may have missed, or one that's worth reappraising. This week, with Elizabeth Olsen's starring role in Wind River, we went back and dug out her debut role in the 2011 psychological thriller Martha, Marcy May, Marlene, in which she plays a young woman, Nadia, haunted and damaged, it's fair to say, by painful memories and apparent paranoia, who's struggling to kind of re-assimilate herself with her family after fleeing an abusive cult. And amongst listeners who went back and watched it with us, what are the comments?
Yeah, Wayne Edge writes in to say, just finished watching Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. And what a fantastic watch. I found it very claustrophobic. The audio in the film was excellent and told the story. Unbelievable debut from Elizabeth Olsen and great performances all round.
Especially, he adds, John Hawkes, who I found very believable.
Yeah.
Mm.
Ian Gilchrist said, I'd watch John Hawkes read the phone book. Where's he been?
I don't know. Well, he did Winter's Bone.
Yes.
He was excellent in that.
Also set in the Catskills.
Ah.
Yeah. And also, didn't he do that movie where he plays a paraplegic or a quadriplegic?
Yes.
With
I forget
Helen
the name
Hunt?
Of that.
Yeah. Is that it? Yeah, I can't remember what it's called, but there was a thing about that.
He's great, though, isn't he?
Oh, I would watch him...
Reading the phone book?
Yeah, reading anything, honestly.
Would you watch him as a tracker in The Wintry Waste of Wyoming?
Give me a drink and I might.
All right, it's okay.
Ben Keeler said, great, great film. Been recommending it since I first saw it. What's Sean Durkin been up to since Southcliffe? Last I heard, he was doing a Janis Joplin biopic.
Right, is that right?
Yeah, I've heard that. And I've also heard that he's been working on an adaptation of Little House on the Prairie for a long while.
Long-awaited adaptation of Little House on the Prairie.
Indeed. But he's also recently become a dad, so I think he's been doing that as well.
So this was his debut picture.
Yes.
Which is pretty remarkable, no?
Yeah, so I think The Boys at Borderline, so he's part of a trio of filmmakers with Antonio Campos and Josh Mond, and they had been working in a really kind of democratic fashion, actually, where one of them would make a movie and the other two would produce it, but also do smaller jobs to make cash to make the movie. Mm. And so this was Borderline's second film. He'd produced it on the first one, which was After School. And so he's been working with Borderline, but not had a directorial real credit with them since then. But this Little House on the Prairie adaptation is apparently going to be his next one for them.
Right, okay.
But this film is, of course, based on a short that he took to Cannes, I think, a couple of years before that, which actually has Brady Corbett, who's in this movie, in it. And that won, I think, Best Short Film that year and got them their deal with Fox Searchlight. So he is kind of responsible for them stepping up a gear, I would say.
Nice one. Well, it's a magnificently and very assuredly handled film, this. Any other comments you'd like to throw out? I've got Tom Dorrow here who says the title refers to the songs Marlene and Marcy's Song by Jackson C. Frank. I was not familiar with Jackson C. Frank. Was a contemporary of Paul Simon on the 1960s folk scene in London, intriguingly. But while Paul Simon went on to huge success, of course, Jackson C. Frank ended up in, well, he died in obscurity, penniless and homeless. But a couple of songs in this are actually... Patrick, the cult leader, plays Marcy's song, and that is a John C. Frank, a very haunting number too.
Yeah, I'm really glad we picked this, given, you know, Elizabeth Olsen's role and what she has to do in Wind River, because this is just such a far meatier role for her.
Right.
And I actually saw this film in the Cannes Film Festival in 2011, mm-hmm. in the Uncertain Regard strand, which is kind of the secondary competition where they put the lesser known directors and people who make weirder stuff. And
what does that actually translate as, Uncertain Regard?
I guess it's a certain look or a certain point of view.
Basically, trying to say, so give this film a squiz.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you find all sorts of weird and wonderful and undiscovered stuff in there. And I watched this film and actually then did an interview with Elizabeth Olsen on the beach with a sort of collection of journalists, international journalists. And yeah, it was very depressing, actually, because you could tell she was very excited to be there and not yet jaded by the industry and very keen to kind of talk about the film and the role. And people were just asking her about her sister's fashion collection and all this. So it was disappointing. But yeah,
right.
When she did speak about the role, it was really interesting hearing a kind of young actor starting out really speaking with such maturity and authority on like the character and, you know, the performance. It was, yeah.
Qualities that she's brought to The Scarlet Witch in abundance.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. David Skur says, love this film. David actually wrote in a much longer one as well, but the short version is, it's an underrated US indie, one of the best directorial debuts from Durkin, one of the best acting debuts from Olsen, and one of the best open endings. Discuss, please. But that ending, okay, so... what does it mean? And, you know, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't watched it, go away, watch it, come back, and now continue. Nadia, what does the ending mean?
Do you know, when I rewatched this movie recently, I've always felt like the ending wasn't up for grabs. I was just like, it's clearly about this. And then I watched it with my fat mate, who is an actress, and she was like, it's clearly the opposite. And I was
all
like,
all right, so what are those two, this and the opposite?
So it's whether you think she's actually ever escaped this cult or not. Like, whether you think actually she has made it out, and this is a film about recovery and healing yourself.
Right.
Or actually this is a much kind of darker thriller, which is about this awful, awful, very ambiguous cult. And I think that's one of the real strengths of the film, is that actually you never really know what the cult's about. Like, it sort of has elements of religion and self-sufficiency, but also capable of like terrible crime and rape. And so, yeah, there's a version where you think she's made it, or there's a version where you think they're going to catch up with her any second now.
Yeah.
And I have always just assumed the darker version, which may be about my personality, but
possibly so. The ambiguous nature of the cult, and I thought that was one of the really nice things about the film, the way that the kind of juxtaposition of life in the cult with the mindset of the family that she then rejoins, particularly, and this is a genius move of having the priggish English guy in there, which just ramps up the awkward to 11.
Oh, he's great. And Sarah Paulson as well.
Yeah.
Sarah Paulson.
So neither, it never really says, and this is civilization and that's not, because they both seem, you know, which one makes more sense, which way of living makes more sense. The film doesn't really come down on either. Watching it again, I'm pretty convinced that, as you say, she's never actually left, or at least she's tried to leave, but the fact that she's called them up, the fact that her sister's going to take her to an institution, she said, I cannot be alone, and the fact that when they do run into the other cult members on the road, she doesn't in any way warn her sister and her partner about them. She's just sitting there waiting in the back. She is basically returning to the cult with that and offering up the sister as a sacrifice in that. I think that would be my take on that.
Given the way that, you know, when I, now that I'm make films myself, I think actually going back and watching this movie and watching the audacious, like, daringness of those cuts and how disorienting they are means that you have no real sense of any form of linear time in this movie. And actually when I rewatched it, I was like, some of these scenes could be set after she goes back to her sister, for all I know. Like, actually, does she return to the cult? And this is a sort of, because you're so, and it's genius because it's not Sean Durkin being clever. It is reflecting this poor girl's fractured mental state that things make her think of other things and you jump about all over the place. So actually I think the whole film really makes you question in a way that's not at all irritating what is real. I don't actually trust anything to be real in this film.
I think it was also really, I found it interesting that he chose that stretch of story, and I know that there's different stretches being melded into one, but normally it wouldn't be surprising to see a writer or a director with a girl escaping from a cult to make a centrepiece of this the moment when the cult catches up with her again. And the fact that he stops before that moment of high drama, I thought was a really interesting decision.
Yeah, he makes a lot of brave choices in this film, I think.
But also at its heart, it's a film that asks really meaningful questions about the nature of family. And like, actually, you know, and that's what John Hawkes' character keeps offering, this whole sense of we want to be your family. And, you know, and it's a film about two orphan girls and actually seeking parental figures, and that's the thing that sits with you, like that haunts you for hours after watching it, is going, you know, A, why do nice girls end up in cults? Like, what could she have been running away from? And there are all these things that are hinted at, but just that really fundamental, like, yeah, like you say, this sort of stifling, bland, middle class existence that she's obviously lived before then, like, actually, what is truer to her? And I think there's a beautiful moment where she takes off all her clothes to jump in the lake, and you think, oh, this is really joyous. And then, of course, her sister comes and covers her up. And that, for me, really sums up. And, you know, and the English husband's sort of slightly sniffy about it. You know, Hugh Dancy having a marvellous time. But I think that kind of sums up the film, actually, about, like, there are really good reasons for people to run away.
Simmering with tension, slow-paced and ambiguous, this is US indie cinema far removed from the Main Street type, accustomed to spoon-feeding its audience so it can go on living happily ever after. That's David Skuer again. He certainly liked this film, and I think we share his opinion, Adam.
Yeah, very much so. I hope he likes next week's choice as well.
What have we got next week?
Next week we're doing Requiem for a Dream in preparation and hopefully celebration from Darren Aronofsky's new film Mother.
Mother!
Exclamation mark.
Ding!
Requiem for a Dream from 2000, I believe.
Yeah, amazing film.
Amazing film. Jared Leto.
Jennifer Connelly.
Mm. Yeah.
What's her name? Burns?
Marlon Wayans as well.
Yeah, Marlon
Wayans.
A film I haven't seen for a long time, actually. Film I'm almost quite petrified to revisit.
Right.
Just a word of advice for anyone who hasn't seen it and will be doing so for this film club. Don't watch it, you know, late at night on your own or, you know, watch it when you're in a good mood.
And not with your parents.
Yeah. or any young ones.
No, yes.
Most decidedly not. All right, so Requiem for a Dream, one of Aronofsky's finest. We'll also be reviewing his new one. What's the other film we're doing next week?
We'll be doing Victoria and Abdul.
Ah, interesting. Interesting. A film I know very little about.
Yeah, it's Judi Dench as Queen Victoria, sort of later, older Queen Victoria.
Mm. Rarely, judging by the movies that they keep making about her, has a historical figure been so widely misunderstood as Queen Victoria. I'm just throwing that out there. I haven't seen the film yet, but that's what I expect to take from that. The image that we have of Queen Victoria and her mindset and the kind of philosophies that she infused her era with seems to be entirely removed from the philosophy she personally lived by.
I'm trying to think.
That seems to be Hollywood's message.
Who was the queen that Judi Dench played in the one
Queen
with
Victoria.
Billy Connolly?
Oh, Queen that's Victoria. Queen Victoria.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Mrs. Brown's something?
Exactly. Yeah.
Mrs. Brown's
boy.
Not boy. I think this is set sort of after Albert's death.
Right.
Yes.
And is when she's kind of...
And what about him? I mean, clearly there's not much Victorian about what he was getting up to as well.
Yeah, there's no film about him.
Yeah. Because there's a story to be told there.
I'm sure, yeah.
I just feel sad that Judi Dench is running out of queens that she can play.
Well, that's why I wonder whether she's played whether that was a different one, because I thought it's odd that she's played Victoria now twice and Elizabeth and probably some others.
Probably some others.
She's great, though.
Yeah. She's Judi Dench.
We interviewed her many years ago, and during the interview, her phone rang, and it was the James Bond theme.
Ha!
One of those kind of polyphonic... ringtones that we used to have.
Excellent.
Yeah. Nice, nice. Anyway, well, that's another busy week for us then on Truth and Movies. Do get watching that Requiem for a Dream. Send your thoughts, please, to truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or via Twitter, LWLies, or as ever, you guys will be putting it out on the Facebook page as well. Anything else you'd like to talk about, Nadia, before we disappear into the ether?
No, I'm leaving here and I'm going straight to a screening of God's Own Country, which I am really, really excited about. Yeah. So that is my treat to myself today.
Okay. Yeah, we did that last week and loved it, didn't we?
Oh, yeah, very much. I hope you enjoy it.
I'm very excited. Anticipation 5.
Bingo.
If I could just slip in a cheeky plug for our new print edition.
Oh, that's true.
Which is out hopefully at the end of this week, start of next week. And Call Me By Your Name is the cover film, which is possibly my favourite film of the year. That's the sound of James leafing through the
issue. Yeah, I mean, it's a gorgeous magazine, as you probably know, listeners. Very colourful. And the usual high-quality paper stock as well.
It smells good as well. Have you ever smelled it?
Does it?
It does smell good. I often say to people, Little White Lies, worth reading, but more worth sniffing.
I mean, the smell, unfortunately, doesn't... Well, we hope it doesn't transmit through this...
Print's still a little small.
Audible medium.
But, you know... anyway, yes, yeah, so that's well worth picking up because you'll look like a better person for carrying it around.
You'll look more intelligent and cooler.
All right. Excellent. And it's not available in most places, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, it's available in most good places.
Ah, perfect. Yeah. Excellent. All right. Or you could just listen to us. We'll be back next midweek doing those films. Many thanks, Nadia, for being with us today. Adam, to you as well, and you, listener. We'll see you next week. This has been a 7 Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.